Let me give you a couple of announcements that you've probably already heard before, but I want to do them again. The voting meetings are October 23rd, October 25th, and October 30th. The October 23rd meeting is 5:30. The October 25th meeting is 6:30. And the October 25th is 5:30. And you have received an email today to that that will tell you that. The forum is October 9th, 7 p.m. at the second floor of the old courthouse. And that would be my announcements for today. First on the menu, Weights and Measures. And Mr. Ellis is here in the back of the room. Go ahead. Welcome to the 2012 budget, 2013 budget.
I don't have any OTRs this year. I will stay within my recommended budget. I'm pretty much here just in case anybody has any questions.
Well, you want to see what's up on the screen? That's a recommended. And
yep. There's only I did increase my revenues because of the new DJ store, so that helped my revenues a little bit. Everything else is the same except for salary and fringes.
Don, you want to use that microphone?
Oops, sorry. Yeah, everything's pretty much the same except for salary and fringes. I did increase, like I said, my revenues because BJ's has opened up now, so that'll help help me out there if I can get them to pay.
I will call them.
Okay.
And your full-time equivalence is 1.0, and
yep.
There are no over-target requests.
Nope.
Question. Carol, go ahead.
Well, that was my question, was whether you were managing to keep your, at least your full-time
yes.
Job.
Yep. Martha.
Hi, Don. I don't know if that was just a throwaway comment, but what do you mean if I can get them to pay?
They haven't paid their bill yet, and I've issued late fees, and they still haven't seen any check yet.
But that's not your job to collect it, is it?
Yes, it is.
Mike and then Pat.
I guess maybe this is a rhetorical question, but every year we look at this budget and we look at this one-man show here and what a great job he does. When are we going to bite the bullet and decide that we need to have some redundancy in this department so that someone gets sick or retires or whatever? We have someone that knows the job and can take over. It means adding a position or a part of a position or something, getting back to where we were years ago. I really think, probably not this year, but I really think next year we need to think about that as an over target.
And you're asking us to do that, and we will do that. Pat.
I don't know if you said they didn't hear it, but how late are they?
Pardon me? How late?
Yeah.
The first inspection I did, I think, was late January, early February.
And when should that have been paid?
Usually I give them 30. On the invoice, it says 30 days.
Uh-huh. And then is it every 30 days after that?
Technically, it's every day. I could hit them, the way the law reads, it's $600 for the first day after 30 days and $1,200 for each additional day if I wanted to. I usually go 2 to 3 months before I issue late fees or call them and remind them. And then it's usually about every 2 months after that I either hit them with another late fee or call. Usually it's once I start the late fees, it's keeps adding on.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Dooley.
I appreciate Mike's calling our attention to our solo staff, but could you tell me what you have been unable to do again this year?
Primarily the time devices like car washes, laundromats, package checking. It's only by complaint basis, and pricing accuracy is by complaint basis right now.
Carol?
Yeah, I wonder if one way to get some relief into this department would be to put some of the collections, particularly big, tough ones like this, whether that could be picked up somewhere else. Is that maybe a question for Joe?
But the county attorney,
I think if this becomes, if this goes on longer or if it becomes chronic, we could certainly turn it over to the county attorney.
Yeah. That's what's been done in the past. If, usually the businesses pay after the first late fee. For some reason, BJ's is an exceptional case. Normally it doesn't take me a lot of time. I'll sit down some afternoon when I get back to the office early, go through the files and start making phone calls, reminding the businesses. And that usually gets the bills paid. There's a few of them that are still late, but once I issue a late fee, then the bills get paid. So it usually doesn't take a lot of time to do that.
Pam, I know we don't have much to ask you, but we're focusing in on this. I tend to agree with Carol that this is something that just seems so completely extraneous to what your job is, mm-hmm. That I don't know why we have you doing that. So my understanding is that you have gone there once. I mean, you usually go in January again, or once a year?
Yeah, I usually show up once a year.
Okay. All right. Okay, thanks.
Well, thanks, Jim. I would reinforce the call for the fact that redundancy, I think, would be a very good thing and help. Okay. I am not remembering your fee structure. I'm assuming there's a proportionate to the size of the business or whatever? Or
no, it's a fee per device.
Per device. So there would be a proportionate. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like in the gas stations, it's $20 a measuring chamber. In the grocery stores, it's $20 per scale up to a 33-pound scale. And from 33 pounds up to 660 pounds, it's $40 and so on up the line.
And without dwelling in this particular business, which, you know, but I'm just to the magnitude of something like this where you're not getting paid, is it?
Usually by the end of the year or first part of the next year, all the businesses have paid.
Yeah.
So I don't have an outstanding invoice roll on for a long period of time.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you, Don. Oh, go ahead. Brian?
Did I hear you right? Did you say $1,200 a day?
Yeah.
After.
Yeah. For second and any subsequent violations.
Just let them go. I've got almost $200,000.
Carol.
Yeah. If people on F&I are interested, we could maybe take up the notion of how long to give people just a warning before we have a county policy. You know. Imposing a county or changing the county policy to be one of a certain amount of time, and then you pay the fine. We can discuss that.
Anyone else? Yes.
Don, in terms of personnel, given all that you have to do and some of what you just said, how much more effective or efficient would your department be with an additional person?
As far as the devices go, I'm getting pretty much all the devices done except mm-hmm. for the timing. It would be beneficial to the consumers if I had somebody part-time that could do, or even full-time, that could do the pricing accuracy and package mm-hmm. checking. That would help quite a bit.
Tell me a little bit more what package checking means.
Package checking means you go into a store, if the package was a box of cereal mm-hmm. and it says 10.5 ounces, what the person would do would tell the store that they're there and what they're doing. They would empty the product out of the box, weigh the box in the bag for a tear. They do two or three of those, and then they'll go through and weigh all the rest of the boxes and find out whether they actually have the 10.5 ounces of cereal in them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Don.
Thanks.
See you next year. personnel. And personnel budget page is 291. In case you're interested. Good evening, Anita.
Good evening.
Good evening.
so you ready? The first slide then shows our 2012 modified budget, which is 682,027, and a fairly substantial change for 2013 recommended, and the change is $137,219, or a 20% change. That 20% change represents the OTR for training money that Joe is recommending in the budget, and also a contract for negotiations with the Road Patrol for a legal firm to do our ongoing negotiations with the Road Patrol unit. So that's the total. And that shows the $30,000 for the recommended outside counsel for Road Patrol and $84,000 for the training initiative. In the narrative, in the pages, in your budget book, under training, it outlines $15,000 for diversity training under the purview of WDSC, under their recommendations and their authorization. And that's in part as a follow-up to the climate survey and the ongoing work of WDSC under Leslin. Also, because there's been a reduction of countywide workforce over several years because of budget constraints, there's a strong need to have more of an organized way to do proficiency training for all county employees, and that would be an enhancement and to augment what some departments have in their own training funds from either the state or from other sources. So that's the OTRs, and I think that's pretty much our presentation.
Questions, please, Rich. Peter Stein, you have your hand up?
Yes, I did.
Please use the microphone.
Yes, sir.
So it's only diversity training. That's the whole expenditure for that.
No, $15,000 of the money that's being requested as an OTR would be for diversity cultural competence training under the WDSC
initiative. What's the rest of it?
And the rest of it I'm going to ask Joe to speak to.
Okay, thank you.
And
Joe, you want me to do that? Okay. And tonight's kind of an interesting night because a couple of things that we've talked about with respect to this budget will be on the agenda tonight. Just for a little background, all of you know that we've reduced our roster, as Anita said, and we've reduced it by 9% over the last 3 years. So one out of every 11 county positions that used to be here isn't here any longer. We're asking everyone to do more with less. And as we set up this budget, as we talked to many of you, there was a sense that there needs to be a commitment to provide those employees who we've asked to do more with less the tools that they need to do that. And those tools come in the form of technology and training. So the training element that Anita is talking about tonight is one part of that, and Greg will be here later on to talk about the technology part. So, again, there's $84,000 in an OTR, $15,000 of which is for diversity, cultural competence, and so forth. The other $69,000 is, I guess we describe it as proficiency training, skills training, providing people really the opportunity to master their jobs, to learn new things, to allow an MEO, for example, in the highway department, to learn how to operate heavy equipment so they have opportunities to advance in their careers so they can do those things. So, again, it's a broad organizational initiative. It can apply to virtually all of our employees. It's roughly equivalent to $100 per employee. Specific allocations, we're going to spend some time with department heads, if you approve the allocation, to talk to them about how we can best target this money. But again, just in terms of some for instances, in terms of supervisors, you know, working with supervisors to help them learn how to effectively do annual performance reviews and discipline and quality assurance. Staff things like how to deal with difficult people, basic skills like access databases, things like that. Managers, you know, I could take this course, how to conduct an efficient meeting. Things like that to help us become very proficient and very skilled at our jobs is what we have in mind with the money that's been set aside for the training.
I have Frank and Pam. Thanks, Jim.
Anita, we've had a year and a half or so under the new insurance consortium. Have you seen any savings at all, particularly in the personnel line, with regard to that move? You know, the fact that we've pared down some, may have pared down some responsibilities or whatever?
For the staff in personnel? No, in fact, if anything, it's growing, not decreasing. The efforts of the consortium and the consultants who work for the consortium are also developing through their joint committee initiatives in the area, in the areas of wellness programming, where we'll be doing more work, hopefully coordinating with the other municipalities on wellness. There's also some discussions about other entities joining this consortium, and for example, it's a small one, but soil and water conservation is coming under the sort of the umbrella of the county plan, as is TC3 in the library. So the benefits managers' work in the area of health insurance was not diminished by joining the consortium, because a lot of the regular work goes on. In addition to that, we're changing vendors more often than we used to, at least in the area of prescription drugs. There's been a transition 2 years in a row. We're expecting one in January for 2013 as well. And when those kinds of transitions occur, it does increase the work of several people in the department to make sure that there's a coordination of effort, a rollout plan, the communications for all those. And then every year there's just the ongoing update January 1st that has to go on for both Major Med and the prescription drug plan. I did want to, if I could, Jim, just add to what Joe said. The work that will hopefully be rolled out in the area of training is also in conjunction with some of the smart work projects that have been funded through Joe's efforts in the legislature over a two-year period. At least 10 of those smart work projects have occurred in our departments, and I think we'll be bringing back a report to you later on so that it's not all anecdotal, but those efforts in many areas, especially in personnel, have allowed us to keep the staff at the level that we've had for several years by improving on process and not asking to hire more people to do the work, but to improve the way the work is done. And that's what the training should enhance as well.
I have Pam, and then I have Martha and Carol. Go ahead, Pam.
Well, I'm all in favor of putting money towards training. I think it's really great. I do have a question about supervisory training. It's something that I think is incredibly important, and I'm just wondering whether the supervisory training that you plan to hold will be all supervisors will be required to participate in that. Is that a required kind of thing, or is that purely volunteer?
We haven't talked about whether it's required or not required. Okay. I don't know if Anita has thoughts on that or not.
I don't at this point, because I'm not a big fan of requiring everything for everybody. I think identifying needs and opportunities makes people more receptive. And the next step, if this is approved, would be a number of meetings with the department heads to develop a plan that really is the most effective, because training... There are some people who love training, and they will go to all the training that we can provide, and there are other people that unfortunately could probably benefit a lot. So getting the buy-in of the department heads is going to be really important if it's successful.
Okay, I'd just like to finish that up, because I agree with what you just said, Anita. I mean, I think that getting people to have buy-in is critical. But I do think that the tendency is that perhaps for the people who might need the training the most, they may not even recognize that they need the training, and they would be maybe the least likely to go and be trained. That's where that comes from. But if somehow you have a mechanism within the departments with the department heads, you know, identifying people who might benefit most from it, that I think would be a good idea. So thank you.
Martha?
Thanks, Anita. I appreciate the conversation about training. I'm looking at... this revised page that we got, the overall budget, and I see there's a requested OTR $14,733, and then fringe under salary and wages, and then fringes $87,500. That's not recommended, and I don't see any documentation of that.
I know the answer.
The first sheet, with the call, the all the departments and everything on it.
Yeah, and there's no other documentation.
That is a mistake. That was developed before we had a change in available resources, so that should be 2 and 0.
What page is this, Martha? It's page 291, and it's a buff-colored sheet, so it's the new.
Those two OTRs reflect money that would have been requested in the budget to do our laser fiche process, but we brought forth a resolution that the legislature acted on at their last meeting. So those numbers, the fringes and the payroll money, should not be included.
So in other words, we've already covered that in this year's budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was covered out of contingent, I believe.
Okay, great.
That's the last meeting. I have Carol, Brian, Pam.
My question just got answered. Thanks.
Brian.
I think mine did partially. This, are we going to get an updated one of these?
Yeah, I had a new one, and then I realized I didn't change this part, so I didn't hand it out. So it says 1 and 1 on that, and it should be 2 and 0.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a shutout. Pam?
I guess I had, this isn't directly in your budget, but it's something that I know that is of concern to many of our legislators, and it's the whole idea of having somebody who is overseeing our hiring process in terms of diversity and inclusiveness, and we know we are measuring up and whether the process is being followed. It feels as if this falls through the cracks. And if I just would hope you could speak to us a minute about that and help me understand that better, and if perhaps the legislature needs to look at this if we don't have somebody who's actually really doing that full time.
Well, I think it's been an ongoing discussion at WDIC, and Lesen may wish to speak to that.
No.
Next.
Oh. No. But I meant in terms of staff overseeing this process.
Yeah. I don't know if you're asking me, do we need another staff person, or should we be doing a better job of overseeing
the
process?
Well, do we have somebody who actually oversees that?
In terms of the workforce utilization, I guess that's my responsibility, and all of the staff looks at that, both in recruitment strategies and in hiring, and we do report out to Budget, Capital, and Personnel about the utilization report monthly or every 2 months. Are we meeting the expectations for an organization of this size? I would say no, and there's more work to be done in that area. I'm not sure that I have the exact answer as to how to improve things overall. We continue to work with the department heads, who have been very committed to trying alternate strategies to recruit where they can, to create a more diverse pool of candidates.
Anyone else?
Jim, thank you, County Administrator. I do want to thank the County Administrator for including in that OTR funding for the WDIC initiatives. I wanted to make sure that it is clear that it is not just for training. I hear that we're training a lot, but primarily for a lot of the initiatives that will come out of our climate survey, and will include also additional surveys of our workplace as we go along, as it's one of the things that was priority that people want to know, continue to keep a pulse on how are we doing as a county relative to diversity and inclusion work. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear, and to thank the county administrator for making sure there's money is included in the budget for it. Clearly, it's not nearly enough, but it is a good place to be in so that we can continue this work, because it can't happen without funding. So thank you for including it in the budget.
Anyone else? Go ahead.
Well, I have a question for Lesen, because now I'm more
confused.
Well,
Lesen didn't ask a question. She made a statement.
I'm more confused now. The $15,000 that was characterized as being for WDIC recommended training, I thought it was for cultural competency training. But you're saying it'll go for other things.
So the priority
Who decides? Is it Anita who decides? Or where does the...
Recommendations from WDIC and through the county administrator. That's the head honcho. But with recommendations that come from WDIC on the initiatives that are being rolled out.
Anyone else?
So if there's a budget somewhere, will have a budget somewhere.
Yeah, it'll be broken out. So the $15,000 will be broken out so we can track expenditures within that $15,000 allocation. Yes.
And you're the one, you're the decider.
Well, I'm the decider, although, I mean, I think Leslin has stated it well. It's really, it's based on the kind of feedback that we're getting out of WDIC, what came out of the retreat and so forth. So there will be accountabilities. It will be reported to the budget committee, as WDIC does.
Well, I'm not on budget, so that's one reason I made.
Neither am I, but
well.
Exactly what I said is what he just said.
Anyone else have questions for Anita or Jackie? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is mental health, and Susan is making her first appearance, and I would hope that you will all be as gentle as you normally are.
Uh-oh.
No, you're not in trouble.
Did I miss the meeting for how we treat the neophyte?
Is this on?
It is. Put it up so you can talk right into it. Don't have to lean over.
Can everyone hear me?
How we treat the newbie.
Okay. Talking about mental health, since I started, a number of people have asked me what do I consider the priority for me as a commissioner and also for the department. So very simply put, I would say that the primary priority for me is the continuation and strengthening of the comprehensive continuum of care for all individuals within the community who have need of mental health, chemical dependency, and or developmental disability services. While this is simply stated, it really says a lot in terms of there are more and more pressures on the whole continuum of care, as you know, as money gets tighter. Part of that system of care gets eaten away a little bit. So I think it's really important that we find a way to continue to provide the services that are necessary for these individuals. So if you look at our overall budget, we have a recommended budget of $10.5 million, which is a little bit higher than before, primarily due to the raises and the fringe benefits. Our revenues are slightly lower. We've lost a little bit more state aid, as has happened over the last several years. And we continue to lose a little bit of money through clinic restructuring, which we'll talk about a little bit more. And we'll talk about the local share in a minute. This is just a breakdown of just to show you where our money comes from. You can see that about 48% of it is state and federal funds. About 34% of it is through billing, that revenue that we generate through billing, and about 18% of it is county dollars. A small percentage of the county dollars does go to other agencies within the community that help support them in providing services for the mental hygiene for this population. But the majority of the county money does go into the mental health department. And while it does support, of course, salaries and fringe benefits, it also allows us to provide a number of services to the community that we're not able to bill for. And some of those services include things like what we do in our forensic unit, where we have someone who attends with other people in the community. Of course, they attend the felony drug court. They attend the sex abuse team court. They attend family treatment team court. We go to the jails. We provide over $1 million. We supervise $1 million program of repayee for some of our clients who are not able to manage their own money. So without the county dollars, it would get more and more difficult to continue to provide those services. So they are greatly appreciated. So the next slide just breaks down really where our state and federal aid comes from. And again, you can see, I can't read it, about 56% of it comes through the Office of Mental Health. A little over a quarter of it comes through the Office of Alcohol and Substance Abuse Services. A very small percentage at this point is coming through the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities, and there's a little bit of federal share. I just want to make one small comment about the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities. It looks like a very small share. What's happened over the last several years is that they have what you would call medicated a lot of their programs so that the actual amount of state aid has been diminished. But it doesn't mean that the programming itself has become diminished. It's just being funded in a different way. Oh, yeah. And in terms of this is just the department budget, but there is more money that comes into the whole behavioral health care system in other ways in the community. But what we're talking about really is the money that comes through our department. So when we talk about the continuum of care, the money that comes through our department goes to a number of different places to help support programming, again, in all three disability areas. You have Challenge, who provides services for primarily vocational services and other services as well for both mentally ill people as well as developmentally disabled. CARS provides for addiction, and you can go all the way down the list. Lakeview provides housing services for our mental health clients, and you can see suicide prevention. So money comes through our department to help support this larger continuum of care that really provides services, again, across the spectrum for this population, for these populations. So some of the challenges for what's what used to be called mental hygiene services is now more known as behavioral health care. So behavioral health care, which includes mental health, chemical dependency, and developmental disability services, one of the biggest transitions and challenges in the next several years will be the move of all of those services into the managed care environment. And what will that mean? What will that mean to funding streams? What will that mean to the type of services that are delivered? Who gets them? How long services are available for people? There are many, many questions about what this will mean to our populations. One of the things that will probably happen in that managed care, one of the focuses of the state right now, if you remember the Medicaid redesign team, part of their plan is how do you curtail Medicaid spending, which we know is all unsustainable. So one of the things that they're looking at is how do you reduce hospitalizations? How do you improve outcomes? So as they go to move everything into managed care, the behavioral health community said, wait a minute, in the past, managed care has been only about managing the dollars, not really about managing the care. So there's really been an effort to create a system that will look at people from a more holistic point of view. And there are some pilot programs that have really shown that by doing a different kind of care coordination, at looking at people from a more holistic point of view and making sure that they get all of the services that they need, that it really everyone wins, that the Medicaid money is reduced and there are better outcomes for our clients. Why does this matter? To just take one step back, I think I'm off on my little tangent, but what we know is that our populations tend to be some of the highest users of Medicaid dollars. Why is that? Because our populations are very ill. They often have more than one illness. They might have a mental illness and diabetes and addiction, and so they end up using a lot of money. They also, our populations tend to die 25 years younger than the rest of the population. So in terms of looking at the system that we're trying to implement, it's how do you provide quality of care in an efficient way for less money? Then as I've talked a little bit about the overarching system, then as you come back down into the department itself, the clinic restructuring, which I'm sure you've heard of more than you care to hear about, really continues to have a negative impact on the overall revenue of the mental health clinic as some of the what's called deficit funding is removed from the system. In the past, we would be paid for, we would provide a service and we would get paid for that and also receive some additional money that would help to fund some of those non-billable things that we provide in the community. That supplemental money is really going out of the system. So the push for departments like ours is to become more like a business and to really look at how we operate internally. So part of what we're doing is looking at the whole department. How do we increase our internal efficiency and productivity? How do we fully implement an electronic health record? Right now we're kind of in this nightmare area where part of our client records are in an electronic system and part of them are paper. It's becoming very unmanageable and difficult to keep track of things. We want to increase our client attendance. We want to, part of what we need to do to increase our overall productivity is to separate out non-clinical functions from the clinical staff. I need them to be freer so that they can do what they're trained to do, which is to provide those clinical services, professional clinical services. And so part of what we're looking to do is to separate out more and to define, to rearrange some of the roles and how some of the things are being done in the actual, in the department. And then we also have to move towards centralized scheduling, which people would be, do I need to explain that? Centralized scheduling in that if someone calls and cancels right now, if a client calls and cancels an appointment, the message goes to the clinician who has to then call the client back. So the client calls, the clinician is in session, the clinician calls them back, the client's not there, and it goes back and forth a number of times, and then everybody gives up, and nobody wins. So by moving to centralized scheduling, it puts more of that ability in the hands of the general support. So if somebody calls and cancels, then they can figure out when an appointment can be scheduled right then, and it takes care of that. So now we're moving into what's the over-target request. It is that we are asking for a case aid that provides general support to our overall clinic. As we've talked about, some of the things that we need to do is to restructure internally. We've lost a number of case aid positions by whatever name they're called because they can be a number of different titles. But over the last few years, we've lost them, a few of them, and we're pretty short. So some of the things that the person would be doing would be, again, helping with that centralized scheduling, making reminder calls to clients. That's really important in terms of assisting with attendance. We want to have them collect more data up front, demographic data, non-clinical, non-confidential data that can be taken right as from a general support person. One of the things that's happened over the last year or so is that as everything gets moved into managed care, all of the psychotropic medications, medications for psychiatric illnesses, have now been moved into managed care. So you have to call and get prior approval before you can prescribe, and different companies allow different medications, and some say, no, we won't provide that dose, and some won't allow that prescription. So it's really become pretty much a full-time job just to stay on top of the paperwork and the phone calls necessary to get the appropriate approval. We're trying to standardize our operating procedures so that people are cross-trained and can work on in any area of our department or on any floor, and just increasing better communication between clients, clinicians, and other administrators. So ultimately, in the end, we end up with, if it's approved, we would end up with one additional staff. That's one more than we had in 2012, but you can see it would still be approximately four less than we had in 2011. So does anybody have questions?
Yes, questions. Pam? Pam and Peter. Go ahead, Pam.
I just was wondering your caseload is like. I mean, are things at the relatively stable, or increasing, decreasing?
We run on average about 1,500 open cases, and on any given month we see around 1,300 people. I have to admit, I don't know what that was. I'm not prepared for that one. Do you know?
We are seeing a little bit of an increase.
Okay.
Please use the mic.
We were seeing about 12 to 1,300 last year, and we have 1,400 active clients at this point. So, yes, some increase, but we are also seeing a longer lag in regard to intake and assessment. We had always prided ourselves on having a really short waiting period, but it's increasing. So clearly,
short waiting period.
To be able to get in.
Oh,
any non-crisis. If there's a crisis patient that walks in, all bets are off. They go right in.
Peter.
That was very instructive. I learned a lot listening to that.
Thank you.
I have a question about the first slide that had something on there that surprised me, or maybe the second, I can't quite remember, which is that a third of your income comes from fees, and I wondered about that. Does that mean you have a large psychiatric practice that people go to?
Yes, we have a mental health clinic where people come to us for all kinds of services. We have several psychiatrists, we have case managers, we have social workers who operate as clinicians, we have nurses. So we see, really, if you look at us within the continuum of care, if you look at the department, we are the ones in the community who see the most seriously mentally ill people in the community.
And that doesn't have to do with the economic level of the patients. Is that correct?
No, that's correct, because mental illness can cross all socioeconomic barriers.
So roughly a third of your practice is that sort of thing? It's a third of the income as well.
It's a third of our... No, well, what I was trying to show you is that our department has two functions. One is the function as the local governmental unit, in which we are the ones that the state gives the state aid to, and then we disperse it to other agencies in the community. And then the other piece of it is we run a department which provides services, direct services to the community.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Martha.
Thank you, Susan. On your full-time equivalence page, it's interesting that in a lot of these cases, you should really go back to 2009. Where am I? I saw on our page, there's page 252, you make a point that right now, even if this is approved, you'll have four fewer than in 2011. Or 2010. In 2009, you had 74 and a half people.
Right. And we're a long way away from that.
A long way away from that, yes. And And I'm concerned about the lag time here. And actually, I have heard that about a waiting list from outside. And
don't use the word waiting list.
Don't use the word waiting list. Lag time.
But we are a little behind. Yeah.
Now, is this case aid that you've requested and that Joe's included, is that going to help in any way? Or?
Well, that will help indirectly. It will help in that if we can pull more of the non-clinical functions away from the clinical people, they will have more time to do what they're trained to do, which is to see clients. The other area of that is we do have someone who just went out on maternity leave, so we've been working with personnel around increasing some hours of other people to try to close that gap, because right now it's traditionally it's a time when a lot of people would be asking for services. Mm-hmm. And so we are waiting 4 to 6 weeks before somebody can get in for an appointment, but we're working to narrow that, to bring that back, because we'd prefer to see people in within a week.
So the person on maternity leave, is that a
That's
clinician?
A clinician.
Or is it?
Yes, okay. It's a clinical person.
I see.
Hi, I'm Brian.
Thanks. I seem to recall that there is a change that either occurred or is going to be occurring as far as the physical layout of the building and access to upper floors and more of a centralized reception instead of multiple reception areas.
That is being looked at, and that's one of the things that I think came out of the Smart Works. Mm-hmm. So that is something that is being looked at.
Okay, I thought we already looked at it.
It would be require some pretty major changes,
both physically and programmatically. And we have made some. I would say we have made some minor changes, because one of the idea that I had in my head would be, we'd have everything downstairs. You know, we'd have one place.
Mm-hmm.
But programmatically, when we did the Smart Work Initiative, we also included clinicians so that we would have everybody's input. And the day-to-day operations and the ability to be able to talk with the case aide / receptionist / scheduler made us put that a little bit to the side. So we've made a couple of changes. For example, we are currently between noon and 1 every day. There is no one person sitting at that desk. There's always a nurse on duty or a clinician on duty. And so we're trying to cover in regard to safety and to make sure that there's always focus on anybody that's coming in the door, because we don't close, you know, between 8:30 and 4:30.
Mm-hmm.
But so that what we're trying to do is mitigate the number of people that we need in order to care for, to take that space when somebody's sick or someone's on vacation. And we've just been juggling. And one of the things that did come out of the Smart Work Initiative is that we need to do an assessment of the safety of the building, and, you know, how are we going to approach that? And I would still like to see, you know, in 3 years' time that's where all of our reception is, and that we figure out our general support. We've got all this cross-training. I mean, it's one of the conversations, probably day one,
mm-hmm.
your first day there, we had mm-hmm. a big session about it. You know, okay, how are we going to do this, and how are we going to move forward? And we really do also believe that an additional person will really buoy, you know, the foundation of the work that we do, so that our clinicians can do more, so we can, our productivity can go up, and, you know, it's a dominoes, only upward
mm-hmm.
instead of this way.
I just thought that it was already in the works. I remember the conversation, and obviously from a safety standpoint, everyone that works there and other clients, you know, to just limit access and have one reception area or one or two
right.
Versus the whole building.
And the reception area on the first floor doesn't. Like if you came to the building, you came up to the third floor, you would see a reception area that is all glassed off, all quadrant, all locked off. If you go on the first floor, that doesn't exist. There are some open areas. We've had some glass barriers put up, but not a structure. It's, you know, if we could flatten the building, literally, we would be able to do it. But yeah. So it's construction. It's, you know, really looking at the safety and more issues than what we have brought up in the past. So we're still working on it.
Okay. Leflin?
I have two questions. Thank you for putting that slide back up. And I was going in the same line that Peter was going in, asking the billing revenue, that's what you're referring to as the fees for the clinical services. And who is that billed to? Is that sort of billed to insurance or the clients themselves, that sort of stuff?
Yes. Okay. We bill probably a little over 50% of our billing comes through Medicaid, fee-for-service money, or Medicaid managed care, but the rest of it comes through third-party insurance or self-pay for the clients.
Okay, so that confused me just a little bit more. Not you confusing me. The state and federal funds, that's not reimbursement for those services. That's just funding you get for...
Right, and help how a girl much out of here. That money comes to the clinic, the state and federal aid? A lot of the money that comes to us through state and federal aid goes out to other agencies. That's part of the role of the local governmental unit. But I think about $2 million, $1.5 million
comes directly to support
the clinic services.
That pie chart. It gets a little confusing because some of the money, you know, is coming in. As Sue said, it's going out also to the community. But but we are part of it. We are part of the community.
So you
because
get
we're
some
providing
of that.
The direct services as well.
Yes, we do get some of the state aid.
Yeah. And is any of that billing billed back to the state?
No, that's direct.
That's direct
payments from Medicaid or third party or Medicare or, all of the insurance agencies.
Thank you.
And I do want to say also that anyone who walks in our door, we will provide services to regardless of ability to pay.
That's one of our kind of mandates is that we are to provide services whether or not someone has the ability to pay.
My second question is, can you... it's troubling to hear about the lag time, especially given some of what we're seeing in our community.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, you have a sense of what the average lag time is before someone gets services?
For the most part, until just the last month or so, we were seeing people within a week, at the outside 2 weeks. What happened is someone went out on medical leave and then somebody went out on maternity leave, so now the one person is back. But it's been kind of, it put us back a little ways. It's very important to us that we reduce that time, that wait time. It's I don't like it.
Thank you. Me neither.
No.
Thank you.
I have both of you, but it's Frank.
Thanks, Jim. Susan, you seem like you've been doing this for years. I heard you mention that the caseload is going up and that it's anticipated to continue, sadly,
to be going up. It's not just the caseloads are going up, but as there's more and more pressure to keep people out of the hospital, one of the things that we're seeing is that people are more acutely ill within the community. So, for example, I just heard that today that we had been seeing someone every day just trying to keep them out of the hospital, and they ended up in the hospital anyways. But people are more acutely ill, so it's not only more people, it's that they are less stable and in need of more intensive services.
Well, my question is anticipating the increase and perhaps the intensity of service, should you be asking, if not this year, next year, anticipating a need for more help. Is one caseworker going to, the one you propose as an OTR, is that going to be sufficient?
Well, I think as I go through the next year, and we'll be talking more about that internally and really looking at, I'm still trying to really make sure that we're operating as efficiently as we can. And this is the first step in that. And then I don't know where next year brings.
May I follow up question?
May I?
Sure.
What, you've been on duty for a couple of months now. What has been your greatest challenge right now?
The budget? No. I think the challenge and the exciting thing is just trying to figure out all the pieces. There's a one of the things I like about Tompkins County is it's rich in terms of the services that are provided to this population, and that's a real privilege to work with. So trying to go around and meet everyone has been both a challenge and trying to figure out where the department is and how it's functioning. So
we're all looking forward to the Health Planning Council's shindig so that we can all meet you officially.
I have another PowerPoint.
Carol and Martha and Will.
I have two questions. One is about the outdoor space.
Outdoor space?
I seem to remember a year ago or so.
You guys were thinking about doing
something with landscaping outside. Did anything ever come of that? Did we ever provide that?
That's still something that it's in the hands of our board. We are hoping to do a recovery recognition type of garden and also a welcoming, because I'm sure that you can imagine, especially if you're pretty ill, trying to walk in the door is a challenge, and we want to sort of put our arms out, and it's also to honor Bob. Because it was an idea that he had. So the board has been bringing forward some architectural designs, and, you know, we talked about all getting our shovels and coming out there. So we'll be in planning stages again during the winter.
So are you talking about doing that as a fundraising project or as a request to the county? Or?
No, we would. Well, our idea is to do it as a fundraising, you know, to have people buy bricks or, you know, benches or, you know, whatever. But there was never any talk of bringing it to this.
Right. Okay. And then I just have a question about, I'm confused about your budget. There must be an explanation. It's the administration portion of the budget on page 253. There's a big figure for contractual services that's a negative figure within the expenditure category.
Yeah.
And then overall, there's a net local of it that's a negative figure. So
yeah.
I just want to know, are we allowed to do that?
And I had that question as well. So what is this? But in reality, part of the personnel that end up under the Mental Health Administration are people that really provide services for the whole department. So we have our billing staff would be part of that. And yet we bill for the continuing day treatment program, we bill for case management, we bill for the clinic, and those are three different programs. So each one of those programs contribute to the overhead of the agency. And Betsy could probably explain more what's in that in that category, but I had that same question.
Yeah, I would call it administrative and overhead instead of contractual services. If you were to follow that line the whole way on the budget, here's the negative, and then the clinic kicks in X and all of the other units
okay.
within the department. So it's, you know, so it's it, instead of showing a plus on the side of actual funds coming to administration. That's just the way it's been done over the years. But it's a good question. I asked
right.
that too when I first.
And so the fact that there's the net local is a negative number is just that.
It's because it's such a large number, right?
Okay.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
I am Martha.
Susan, on one of your early slides, you say that the inclusion of behavioral health care into managed care will continue to affect the overall service delivery and funding streams. Is that a national trend, or is that what New York State is trying to do?
Both. It really is happening nationally. I think that across the country, the Medicaid costs have become unsustainable. Certainly in New York, we're a pretty heavy Medicaid state, and so the costs had to be contained. So it really is across the board.
Okay. And then I'm going to go to page 252, where you have your whole roster, and to pick up on what Leslin and Frank said about this lag time. And I'm looking at 2009 in the roster, and I'm comparing it to the 2013 target. And I may have the titles, like the relevant titles, wrong, but let me see what I've got here in terms of direct service people in your clinic. I see, compared to 2009, we're down 3 caseworkers from 14 to 11. We're down 3 clinic supervisors from 6 to 3. We're down 1 continuing treatment specialist from 3.7 to 2.7. We're down 1 nurse practitioner from 2 to 1. We're up program director CSS, is that community support specialist? Or
services. It's our case. That's our case management program.
Case management. We are down 1.5 psychiatric social workers from 13 to 11.5, and down a supervising psychologist from 1 to 0.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's picked up by somebody else, but the net looks like direct service took a huge hit in this drop of your personnel. And it just seems like not an accident when you're now talking about being on such an edge when somebody's on maternity leave or on sick leave, then you see it sounds like immediately in the time people have to wait. Now, I don't really like to compare departments, but I think this is where resources need to go, and I don't know if we can wait till next year. And compared to weights and measures, I think this is a priority, and I don't know how would you'd react to that.
I hate to interrupt, but I hope it's going to end in a question.
How would you react to that? Do you think this is, I see you've asked for the case aid, and that's, are you being modest, or the other question is, if you bring in any of these positions, do you get partial reimbursement? I know in social services, for example, bringing in a certain position, you actually get a third or a quarter of that person's salary covered.
Not in these positions, no. You asked me if I'm being modest. The budget was submitted 1 month after I started, so I really haven't had... I think Betsy has been great, and we've done a lot of talking, and she wants to say something.
I did want to say the one area, the caseworkers, went from 14 to 10. Those that have left have actually all been because of retirement, and they are because of clinic restructuring. Those were non-billable positions, so the activities that we that they did were not billable. I think that what's most significant at this point is that we lost a nurse practitioner. We still have one online. We're still trying to fill it. And also the psychiatric social workers, losing them, and as you mentioned, too, some of the supervisors. I wanted to add to something that Sue had said earlier, and this is in response to your question, that Sue's bringing to us her expertise and her knowledge of the system, and is also a clinician, mm-hmm. and is very well aware of all that it entails to be a clinician, including the time spent and doing what is known as concurrent documentation, so that you're documenting while you're working with your client. So there are a lot of ways in which we're looking at productivity standards. And it's definitely true that if you said to us, we're going to give you 5 more psychiatric social workers, we would make that work. And that would be really wonderful. However, we do have some constraints. So we talk about our department and our clinic as a business. We need to figure out ways in which to strengthen our ability to increase our revenue through clinic restructuring changes that have made a difference to us and a negative difference. It's just a different way to do work.
I appreciate that, and so what you're saying is the lack of clinic time really is in the clinic supervisor, nurse practitioner, and psychiatric social worker, those 3 positions.
Yeah.
Okay, and don't those folks, some or all of them, bring in revenue?
Oh, yes, they do. Yeah. And a lot of that work is being done by our nurses, more work being done by our psychiatrists. People are, you know, our caseloads are growing in that regard.
Okay, so in other words, not reimbursed as in DSS where there's a line, but they're bringing in revenue.
Right.
Revenue through billing. Yeah.
Right.
All right, I think I will call one of you or both of you about if you were to want one position more, which slot would make the most sense for you?
Mm-hmm. I have Will, and I have Peter.
Thank you, Jim. You guys have been a great tag team, and you know, I think we are very fortunate both to have Betsy's long-term view and Susan coming in, running, and understanding this very, very complex department. Something, Susan, that you said at our last meeting of Health and Human Services was that I guess this was going to be the last year funding for day treatment. Did I hear you correctly at that time?
That there will be a certain portion of money that will be supplemental money that will be pulled out of the continuing day treatment.
Okay.
So we do have a year to figure out what to do with that. And how do we... I still think that there's a need within the community for that level of intensive services because, as I said, people are coming out of the hospital less stable, more acutely ill, so a once-a-week therapy appointment isn't necessarily enough. So how do we structure a program that will be fiscally viable moving forward and still provide that kind of intensive services? So we have a year to work on that, and that's a task that I've already given to that staff, and I'll be working with them, and also involving other people in the community about what ideas do they have, and is there a way we need to partner differently or collaborate with other agencies differently so that we can maintain that level of services, or something that looks, it might not look exactly the same, but something that provides like I said, a little more intensive services than once a week. So something in between hospitalization and just clinic treatment.
Thank you.
Peter, you have your hand up.
Excuse me, Jim. I had a second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Okay. And actually, this is a question that actually may be aimed at Joe or whatever, but you folks pointed out that, you know, a good chunk of our funding comes from Medicaid, and hanging like a Damocles sword over any provider, of course, is the threat that the Medicaid Inspector General will come swooping down and hit you with some kind of awful judgment. Were that to ever happen to us in the unlikely event, is that an insurable expense, or is it something that comes out of contingency, or what?
It would have to come out of the contingency account or out of our general fund reserves.
Yeah.
It's not an insurable item.
So we hope it never happens.
Right.
Thank you.
Peter Stein.
Just sitting and listening to the colloquy between Martha and you, I came away not really understanding how 2 and 2 makes 4. It sounded to me from the numbers that Martha was saying like it was sort of like something between a quarter and a third of the workforce, which had disappeared, that it was down by that amount. And very simply, if you had a workforce of 100 people that were fully employed all the time, were not sitting around waiting for for clients to come in, and now you've got 65 people in the same caseload. There's no way that you could, I mean, you can only get so much of by making it more efficient and reducing the amount of paperwork, but it sounds to me like a huge change in the course of a very short time. And if you're a private practice, you say, okay, we don't take any more people, we're full. But you can't do that.
No,
so
we can't.
I just don't understand. I mean, to me, the only answer is you don't give the same quality care now as you did then, or you had too many people in the past. But I can't think of any other answer. And I'm interested in what you have to say to that.
And I don't know that I can answer that at this point because I wasn't here before. I think we are struggling to keep up with the caseloads that we have. But I also understand that money's not limitless. So how do we really make sure that we're operating at our peak efficiency? And so that's really been my focus in terms of what can we do to optimize what we have. I don't know if you have.
There's also the reality that our billing structures have changed so much. I don't know whether that really answers the question. I mean, it's very possible that 10 years ago there were more than enough people to handle what we had. But as our salaries go up and our fringe rates go up, I mean, and if somebody leaves, it makes sense for natural attrition to take its course. I'm sorry, you...
Go ahead. Only if anybody's watching this on TV. We don't want to create an impression that the service that we offer in our facilities is anything less than excellent. I think if you benchmarked us against other mental health operations in the state, you'd find that we are among the top tier of providers in the state. So as we talk about how we allocate resources and the right number of personnel, again, I think we ought to keep in mind that we do offer high-level quality services and that we are responsive. And if the lag was a week until these two medical leaves and it slipped to 3 weeks or so, but it can be made up over time, that's still a pretty responsive mental health operation. So I just, again, don't want to create the impression that we're anything but very high quality and very responsive.
With that, we will stop. I just want to remind everyone that I think my memory is fairly good on this, that back in 2009 when the world changed, Bob basically showed up here with having to restructure. There was a discussion about that in the department and restructure a lot of things because of funding. And he was able to, you know, convince the legislature that they could still do a maximum service and operate with what they had. So let me just say one more thing, that I think there should be a two-credit course at TC3 for, one, understanding the DSS budget, and two, understanding the mental health budget. And we're going to take a break now. Ed, I'm really sorry. You're going to be like 10 minutes late. Okay? Anything else for Susan? Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you.
Welcome to
Thank
the
you,
budget process.
Thank you.